So my advice to people on the trying to get a higher win rate is prepare in advance, get the financials in advance, create a presentation, and when you walk through it with them, you're displaying your value on that pitch call. You'll have a higher win rate.
Hello and welcome to the Growth's Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Donny Masia from Warrior GP, and we're going to talk about how he has built his fractional CFO business in the mold or with a background, if you like, from investment banking. And he's used that not only as his approach, but also how he wins business in particular. So if you're a fractional CFO, you manage to get people interested, but then you have a problem getting them over the line and closing them as clients, I think this episode will be of particular interest to you. Of course, it wouldn't be a Growth Profit Podcast with a little bit of a case study. So we're going to talk about how Donny can add value to your business. In particular, he's got a case study here from about how he managed to increase the profitability of an online retailer. But before we get into that, Donny, maybe you could introduce yourself to the guests, or the listeners rather, by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Sure, absolutely. So something that not a lot of people know is I got married pretty early. I was 19 years old, and I had my first child the day after I took a calculus test in college. So that's something that I open with sometimes, which is an interesting point about me.
I always wonder about this because my parents had me very young, and my mom was like, well, you know, take it easy, James, take your time. And now I have my kids in my mid-30s and I regret it. Now I really, well, I wasted all that time. You know, I'm going to be in the ground 10 years earlier than I could have been, you know, like if I'd had 10 years missing out on with them. So how do you feel about it on that side? Of course you're glad you did it. We all love our kids, but what's your advice?
Well, you know, the first thing I have to tell people is it wasn't a mistake. I'm just Jewish. So sometimes we get married a little bit earlier. No, I just, when you find the right one and you want to start a life, it's definitely a lot more to juggle, you know, school, work, family, all those things. But I think, like you said, it gets you a little bit of a head start. You learn how to do it. Everyone evolves anyway. And it's the most rewarding thing that I've ever done. So I highly advise it. You just have to be able to multitask a little bit.
Yeah, I agree that. I mean, you hear about no matter how successful people are in business, they always say their proudest achievement is their kids. Well, the rational ones do anyway, right? So, and that gives me sort of confidence, like, okay, actually, in comparison to having a kid, everything else is a distant second in my mind, you know? So no matter what you do, we're all just playing for fun here out on the business side. If you've had a kid, you're a success in life, in my book, you know?
Absolutely. So, and I even think that while in school and having children prepared me a lot for what I was going to end up doing next in the investment banking world. So I'm really thankful that I had that experience.
How so? I mean, what did you learn from that, having to juggle both?
Yeah, so for sure in high stress situations, having to remain calm when there's a lot of different things happening, being extremely efficient with your time. If you're balancing, you know, a part-time job and you're balancing work, and you're balancing school, a lot of times all of those things collide at once. In investment banking, you have a bunch of different deals that you're staffed on. And for those who aren't familiar with investment banking, it's mostly mergers and acquisitions, capital markets, very high stress environments where a lot of people think that the most important thing in the world happening is the deal that you're on. And sometimes those things are colliding, and sometimes those things are happening at the same time. And you have to learn how to be extremely efficient and balance priorities often. And I feel like that's something I picked up on, having children early and balancing other things.
Yeah. I must ask you, blending into this world, because one of my heroes, I guess, if you like, Rob Walling, he's a sort of a tech guru type who sold his business. And he describes selling his business as the most stressful thing he ever did. And when he talks to, and he has three kids, but when he talked to the other side, to the acquirer afterwards, the acquirer was like, oh, I had no idea I was stressing you out like that. I just thought it was a business deal. Is that generally true? Are the sellers generally more freaked out than the buyers? Or is it just as tough on buyers?
Well, I'll say this. It depends on what part of the market you're in. Usually when you get into what we'll call the lower middle market, which hard to believe, but the lower middle market is generally from a $10 million transaction to, let's say, a $250 million transaction. Mm-hmm. All of those transactions, it's usually a family-owned business that it's either an entrepreneur that started up from nothing, or it's been a family business, and it's the biggest event of their life, right? They're going to get a check for $50, $100, $150 million. Of course, it's the biggest thing happening for them. For the buyers, in the most part, they're people who are private equity firms or they're large corporations. They've acquired other firms, and so they're used to it. But for taking something, I always, you know, founders always view the business as their baby, right, as their child, right? Speaking of children, something mm-hmm. that you've cultivated, you brought from nothing. And then there's definitely a lot of emotions that go with it. You're putting it out into the market. You're getting a lot of diligence and questions on it. So it's definitely quantitatively and qualitatively difficult. And then it's also, it's long hours, because it's usually it's a 6 month to a 1 year process. There's a lot that goes into it to find the right home, find the right fit, find the right structure. And there's a lot of things happening very quickly on timelines. So I'd say for sure for the sellers, it's something that's new, it's stressful, but if you do it the right way, it's also very rewarding.
Yeah, okay. And all right, well, let's talk a little bit. So you had a baby, you passed your calculus exam, you had an ambition to get into finance. So tell us a bit about, you know, how'd you get your first job? And then I'm going to ask you a bit about investment banking, because this is going to reflect on how you've structured your business. And there's something interesting about how you win business compared to traditional fractional CFO firms that I'd like to get into. But let's set the scene by just tell us how you got into investment banking. What was your first role?
Yeah, absolutely. So before I was in banking, actually, while I was in school, I started a small concessions business that does, you know, hot dogs, hamburgers, things like that for ballparks and stadiums in the Midwest. So, you know, Wrigley Field, they did for the Chicago Cubs and the Green Bay Packers and things like that. So I learned a little bit about starting my own business early on, the idea of an entrepreneur. Then I just started messing around on spreadsheets and I said, well, you know, this is fun. You know, this is something I enjoy. Friend of mine then told me, you know, there's an entire industry for something like this. If you really like finance, then you should really try for investment banking. So I didn't know what it was. I got connected with a few people who had done it. They all looked very tired, but happy that they were doing what they were doing. And then I got a few prep courses, and just for 6 months, I just studied what we call technicals, which is your accounting and finance fundamentals, from valuation to, you know, technical accounting and all those things. And then just started networking, interviewing, trying to get my internship junior year. Right? That's how it works, is that you get an internship with a bank your junior year, and then if you do well, you get a return offer, and that's really your way into banking. So I ended up landing an internship position at PNC Bank. I did well, got the return offer. I didn't accept it. I ended up going to a private equity firm and a hedge fund as well. Did a couple of internships and made my way a little bit in a different way to an investment bank, where I spent about a couple of years there initially at my first job, and then I did a couple more years at a larger institution as well. But the way into it was just general ambition, I think, a lot of long hours studying, a lot of long hours networking, a lot of coffee chats, because, you know, and just, again, just like speaking to people who don't know it, it's a pretty competitive industry. I think I read a stat somewhere that said Goldman Sachs, which is arguably one of the top banks, you're fighting in the internship position junior year. You know, it's either 20,000 or 50,000 applicants for, let's say, 50 spots or so, right? So it's, yeah, I think by statistics, it's harder to get an internship, I think, at Goldman Sachs than it is to get a spot at Harvard for an MBA. So it's definitely something that is, it takes a lot of time and commitment, but, you know, I'm really happy that I did it.
Yeah, okay. Well, once you do that, it's, once they see that on your CV, right, that's set for life pretty much, right? When you're able to say, okay, this guy went through that rubric, I guess. I guess the difference in Harvard is you're paying them versus in the other way around. So you'd expect it to be a bit more difficult. But,
you know, I actually think it, you know, part of me thinks it should be not necessarily the other way around, but, you know, as an intern, you do get paid. I would recommend to people, you know, if you have an internship, even if it's free, like that experience, what you give them versus what they give you, proportionally, they're giving you much more. And I did a couple of unpaid internships as well for that reason. And so I couldn't agree more on that point.
Yeah. Now, just before we move on, I want to ask you about the hot dogs, because I'm a simple guy, and but we're going to get super technical here. But I think a hot dog business, I can wrap my mind a bit. And I'm asking because Sam Parr, he's a very famous podcaster. He runs My First Million, and he's famous for using, you know, having a hot dog stand is one of his early businesses. So, I mean, how big can you make that business? Or it sounds like this was your first out of college, but like, what are the margins like? Why did you give it up? It seems like it can be pretty lucrative.
Yeah, so honestly, it's still in the family business. My brother took it over once I went out. It's because it's a super simple business model, right? It's you make hot dogs and you sell them and then you keep what's left. What we actually did is that we did it a little bit more at mass scale. That one of the best places in the world to have a hot dog stand would be at Wrigley Field and the Chicago Cubs in Chicago, just because you're not, you know, just standing outside waiting. You're only operating when there are games. And so for us, and also people are willing to pay prices that are, that they wouldn't traditionally pay in other areas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously the difference though, I guess, on the margins and things like that is you obviously have to pay out the stadium and the Cubs and things, and there's commission splits and all that. But in terms of a volume, like, you know, for people who own hot dog carts, I'll say that we're doing thousands and thousands, you know, every homestand, hundreds and hundreds every single game. So it more becomes like a manufacturing type of endeavor when you're doing it at that type of volume. Obviously, you try to put the personal spin on it. You still put on the customer service and things like that. But it becomes more of a volume type than it does, you know, trying to make it personal with each individual, just because there's so many transactions.
Okay. And there, does the, you mentioned the concession charge there, do they suck all the value? And obviously you're still doing it, so no, but do they, the problem with any business like that is whoever you're charging rent to, they can just pump the rent to whatever is going to take most of the value out, right? So is that the case, or how do you mitigate that, I guess?
Yeah, my general advice to people starting businesses is make everything as variable as you can. Get rid of all your fixed expenses when you can, because the more variable you can make it, A, you're going to align incentives with everyone, and B, you don't run the possibility of a loss as likely, right? Obviously, you're going to have fixed costs. That's just the way it is. Minimize them so you get your operating leverage, and you'll see the alignment of incentives as well as the alignment of your P&L.
Okay, a little bit of foreshadowing there, I predict. So you got in, let's go back to investment banking. One question I have about that, I mean, is it unfair? Because investment banking sounds like it's a bank, but as far as I understand, it's not. It's like much closer to an estate agent. Is that a pejorative term? Is that a better analogy?
You know, it's funny because when I told people that I worked at a bank, you know, they imagined me as the retailer that was handing them the money when, you know, do you want 10s or 20s or things like that? And a lot of people don't know the difference between that bank or an investment bank. And then when I told them that I did hot dogs, you know, they were thinking that, what is this? Like a guy who does hot dogs and he works at a bank branch, right? So they really didn't get a grasp on like what I was doing. But yeah, so the way it works generally is there's two types of banks. There's commercial banks and investment banks. And there's been some legal items that separate them. Now they can come back together. But when you think of something like Chase, they have that retail part, right? JP Morgan Chase. And they also have the investment banking part where they do mergers and acquisitions. So usually those are separated. You have the retailer that's, you know, checks, deposits, things like that, wealth management, whatever else. And then you start going into the investment banking part, which is mostly the mergers, acquisitions, the sales and trading, all those things that you hear about Wall Street. It's definitely much more like sales and trading, you know, brokerage, things like that, than it is, I would say, the, you know, the retail type that people think in their head when they see a bank on the street, for sure, right? So if you go back to those types of movies, like, you know, the Wall Street movies, that's definitely more what it's like.
Okay. So before we started, you told me, if I'm getting this right, that in an investment bank, you have something called a deal team. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So maybe you just explain what that is.
Sure. So the hierarchy of the investment bank is, obviously you have the interns when they're there, but the lowest level is the analyst. Usually they're coming out of college and you'll spend 2-3 years as an investment banking analyst. At that point, you're doing the financial modeling, you're doing a lot of the PowerPoint and creation of the deal materials, things like that. After a few years, you'll be an associate, where you're managing the analyst, probably managing a few projects, and you're reviewing the work. You can do the work. You're in the middle role where you're the project manager, we'll say. Then you become a vice president, which is the bridge between, let's say, the junior team who's doing a lot of the work, the creation of the materials, but you're also speaking, you're also running the engagement a little bit, and you're making sure that you have the relationships with the client and you're acting as this bridge. And then you have the managing directors or directors, which are responsible for bringing the business in. They're running the timelines and ensuring the overall health of the project, but they're acting as, let's say, the relationship manager. And then when they have ideas, deadlines, things like that, they convey it to the vice president, who then conveys it to the rest of the deal team, and they're the final sign-off. So, and obviously you work your way up, you know, 3 years, another 3 years, and 5 years, you know, and then you end up as managing director. And that's like the team that you give over to the client on any specific deal, right, in order to ensure that each person is doing what they're supposed to do optimally, because one person doing everything in banking, it would be very difficult to have the same person who's in charge of the relationship and doing the sales, as well as doing all the analysis, is just not a good fit and not a great use of time. And actually, that's the way it works right now in most fractional CFO firms. You have one person playing all those four roles. And that's why I think a lot of people get stuck and they can't figure out, how do I get out of the operations and start scaling my business? And this is the reason why, because you're working on the business and in the business at the same time, and you're taking the role of four different people in one.
Okay. So I can see how that makes a lot of sense. And that's from a sort of working perspective. But how I get the impression that in this world, they also align the financial rewards in that way at the same time. So if you're an associate in that world, you get a taste. Is that what they call it? I mean, what level do you have to be? If you say if you're on a deal team, and as a deal team, first of all, is that for the life of a particular transaction? Or is it multiple transactions? Okay, right.
I mean, you have industry verticals where you'll probably have people specialize and they'll take types of deals, right? You'll have paper and packet. Usually it's by industry. So you have industrial, consumer, tech, you know, and you have specialties. But you usually have different deal teams for each project, and you'll have 6 months or a year or whatever it is. Those people will be working with you very closely and for many hours. You get to know them very well.
Right. So is there a default sort of financial incentive that people, like, you know, in my business, you know, typically, you know, if I have a salesperson, they're getting the first month of MRR, they get that in commission, maybe 2 months under certain circumstances, you know, industry benchmarks, if you like, that structures this. So how do the finances of a team like this work in terms of incentives? Is it mostly base? Yeah. Is it mostly salaried? How does it work?
Yeah. So the typical investment banking structure is, you know, you're definitely very generously paid, even as an analyst, right, coming out of college. Usually what they'll do is, there are some banks, like usually the lower middle market banks, the smaller ones, they'll give some type of commission for the deal that closes, as well as the decently high base. And then you have some type of subjective bonus. Oftentimes for the larger institutions, like the one I was at, the second bank I was at, where we were doing deals from, let's say, 300 million to a couple billion, those ones, you'll usually have a pretty high base salary. And then your bonus is 100 to 150 or even 200% of your base. So you're making they're aligning those incentives, and you have what's called buckets, right? So if someone performs extremely well, they're the top bucket, then you have your middle bucket and lower bucket. But usually it's a decently high base with a very large bonus possibility. And okay, in terms of alignments, that usually does it for people, because they're making most of their money on their bonus.
And like, I'm referencing podcasters all over the place, but there's another one I'm thinking of now, which is, so I've heard of some people who they try investment banking and they're like refugees from it. Like, no, I thought that was going to be it. I'm going to get a huge salary. I'm going to get a huge bonus. I'm going to be set for life. Who does it suit? And who is it like, just it washes them out? Because I know for sure it doesn't suit everyone. Scott Galloway, I think, is the guy who's said that, you know, he got a job in investment banking just because he wanted to beat his frenemy who said, oh, you also wanted one. So he just said, well, if you want it, I'm going to beat you. So, and then he ended up hating it. So who's it suit and who's it really wash out?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of investment banks are recruiting from the top universities. So I think it's definitely somebody who's determined for sure, that wants to unlock a lot of the upper echelons of finance, or, you know, or wealth or things like that. There has to be an ambition for it. I think there's people, like, there are certain people who want to have their career as a lifestyle, and that's okay. And there's some people who even if they make a lot of money and they were working pretty easily, they wouldn't be happy. I think for the typical investment banker, they're often people who have a drive that are looking to work and capable of working longer hours, that are capable of just ambiguous terms, figuring things out, high stress environments, able to multitask and handle a lot of things at once. But they have to straddle this line between being a personable individual as well as a pretty technical individual at the same time, right? You have to be able to like get your Excel calculations, and you also have to be able to talk to a client and make them feel comfortable throughout the life of the deal. So, I mean, I would say it's definitely someone, like when I saw it and I saw the industry, I just fell in love with it. I just said, this is so cool. I'm looking at, you know, we're trading futures of, you know, oil or something, and or, you know, our currencies. And I thought that was really interesting because I like macroeconomics. And then so you're blending that with your finance. And then it's like, well, now I'm looking at this company's financial statements. And then I'm looking at, you know, this type of computer science almost, because I have to figure out how to make this presentation. I have to pull this in from Excel and whatever else. So it's definitely a pretty rounded business individual. The reason why I liked it personally is because I felt like I got the best education I could get. I felt like I spent a few years doing it, and I feel like I got a 10-year education just going into every single business and then seeing what type of levers are pulled in order to make businesses successful. And when I saw that, I said, what's the transferable skill set from there? Because really, investment banking, it's not necessarily about finance. It's just that's most of it. It's an education on business, because you're just, what you're doing is you're just seeing so many businesses and how they work. And so I said, well, why can't I take that and bring it down to the growing firms? And that's the form of a CFO.
Okay. So this brings us to Warrior, and I can't move on without mentioning the name. So you're saying something about your culture straight up with Warrior GP. So tell us about, I'm getting this hard charging kind of vibe here with investment banking, and you're bringing this through to your business, I'm guessing. So where does Warrior come from?
Yeah, so Warrior Group comes from a couple of things. One is, I think that entrepreneurs are modern day contemporary warriors, because to build something from nothing takes a certain type of grit, a certain type of determination, and a certain capability to keep pushing forward. And I think, you know, nowadays that type of culture has been lost a little bit, but I think you still see it in every entrepreneur to build something from nothing. I think you still see that. The other part of it is Warrior has a sense of partnership that and a sense of camaraderie, a sense of team. And we like to join with that team and help the people who are charging forward to continue doing that. So, you know, I know it's a little bit of a hard name, right? People think Warrior, they think of, you know, someone with a painted face and whatever else. We think of it much more as a mentality. Keep going, pushing through, and we'll help you get there.
Well, we're recording early 2025, and we've just had a change of president, and Mark Zuckerberg has just gone full warrior, you know, getting rid of his DEI hires. So maybe you called it. Maybe you called the vibe shift, let's call it, before it happened. Okay, so you are bringing this model of the, I don't know if you still call it a deal team, but you're using this model within your business. I guess what I'm hearing so far is you pay really well. Is that right? You pay
I would say I align incentives very well. I would rather people take more and be incentivized than have the employee type of mentality. Because I think when you think about employees generally, unless you pay them a very good bonus, the employee will do the minimal amount of work in order to satisfy and get their base if they're not incentivized otherwise, right? It's just like, if you just think about it, unless there's certain types of people who do it differently. But the second that you incentivize and you take away the ability for them just to feel comfortable with the status quo, they start reaching because they know everything that they do has that balance back and automatically will benefit them. So I like putting people in the position where they're entrepreneurs as well, and that we do this through partnership as opposed to hierarchy.
Yeah, I'll comment on that. I mean, a bit like your hot dog stand, the top line is fixed. And that's true when you're a staff member, right? Your salary is fixed. All you have to do is flex on your inputs, effectively, right? How many hours you have to work. So, and that comes down to who you're hiring. So if there is a mentality out there of someone who crafts and enjoys their work for the craft of it, if you like, mm-hmm. But let's face it, some of my jobs out there are just not that much fun, in which case that makes sense to do, let's say, to incentivize people with money. And then, I mean, the typical realm you see this is in sales. It's very common. I've referenced it already. Is this attracting people who are actually, you know what, I'm in it for the money. I can make good money here with Donny. Is that a challenge, or how do you screen for that? Or do you care? Maybe it's the right motivation.
So I look for people who are able to motivate themselves, and I don't view warrior as much. So the way that an investment bank works generally is you have the managing directors who are, they have a little bit of a base salary. Most of their compensation is based on their success with clients and ability to close transactions. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, that's what we took over. I mean, obviously there's definitely, you know, there's always payment and things like that, but I want everyone to win together at the same time. I don't want it to be that, you know, if we have a big success with a client, not everyone shares in it. And I also want people to be incentivized the other way, that they don't just feel comfortable that if there's a loss with the client's not doing well, whatever else, that they don't feel like they have to earn that too. So I think when we were screening, if somebody's just looking to clock in and clock out and take a paycheck, that's a certain type of person. But if there's somebody who wants to win and win big, we give them A, the financial ability to do that, but B, we also give them the flexibility because they don't have to do everything themselves, right? They have the ability to leverage their time so that they're able to spend more of it on the management and the strategy instead of just spending it on, let's say, doing the financials.
Okay. And the team that you've built so far, what's your strategy? Some people onshore everyone, some people have leveraged a sort of global economy. Where do you land on that?
Yeah. So it's funny, actually, when I was in banking, so I had a really close friend that worked with me as kind of an overseas analyst. And from there, we just kept in touch for years and years. And eventually said, hold on a second, Donny, why don't you go get the business? We'll do the back end, you'll manage it, and then we'll figure it out. And that's the model that we've built. And we've just expanded that. Now we have 10 CFOs and 10 analysts, and it's the same exact thing, where we'll have the junior resources, we'll call them, the people who are doing the execution of the financial analysis and the financial modeling, and also the creation of the presentation materials and the data visualization. That, to me, is a skilled commodity, and it's definitely something that takes skill, and it's something that's super important. But at the end of the day, that is something that is a commodity. What's not is the strategic finance. What do the numbers then tell me? And then how do I convey that to the client and ensure that I create value? How do I maintain that relationship? So if you can bifurcate between those two things, all of a sudden you have an extremely valuable business where everyone is focusing on what they're good at, and each person can leverage their time based on their skill set. So we have the current model that we have is the junior resources are offshore, right? And we have our warrior office over in India, and then we have the managing director / CFOs. They're all based in the US.
Okay. So let me think of the right way to say this. I mean, you take a different spin on it for sure, but you definitely hear of people building different resources, you know, with doing different, focusing on FP&A or bookkeeping or strategic or, you know, investment M&A. But what really stands out about what you're doing it though, is your approach to winning business, and it struck me, which is that a lot of people will have this experience no matter what business you're in. I guess you know, you meet people who are interested, you set a meeting, you know, you send them a quote and ghost town, nothing happens, you know. So what are they doing wrong, and what do you do differently? What really marks you out that allows you to win your deals? Because you mentioned your win rate before the call, and it's pretty impressive. Yeah. I'd be happy if I had the same win rate for our prospects.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a few things that go into it. One is, obviously, I took over from the investment banking world. When we would pitch a client on a big transaction, right, if you're doing a $500 million, $750 million deal, you're spending a month preparing, right? You need to know everything about the client that's publicly available. You need to know everything about their competition. So you have all these fancy databases that we're using. We're looking at the public trends and things like that about their market. And we need to explain to them why. What are the specific avenues that align us with them in order to make sure you have a successful outcome, and why we're the perfect person to do it, or we're the perfect bank to do it? And, you know, we put together, let's say, a, you know, 90-page presentation on that. We fly out to the client and we treat them with this luxury type of status, right? And so that's something that I think gets lost a little bit in sales. Like, imagine if you can't do that for everyone, but imagine if you were able to do something like that and bring that over to the fractional CFO world. So what we'll do is we'll spend a couple of weeks in advance. If we think that we have a really good prospect, what we're going to do is we're going to spend a couple of weeks reviewing all the material public information We're going to ask for their financials in advance, and we're going to identify the areas that we can help them with so that it's not just this theoretical that I do fractional CFO work. Here's the general things that can help you. It's this is why I'm perfect for you. Here's a nice presentation that outlines it. Here's the type of respect that you'll be treated with. And then all of a sudden, you just have to press OK and press go. Because at that point, it goes from being theoretical to, wow, I know that Donnie or person on Donnie's team, they're going to take care of me. And they've already outlined how my investment in them is going to return. So now all I have to do is sit back. And that's the thing about entrepreneurs also is that they're all A players, right? They're all movers on their own. And so if you don't get in front of them and you don't perform in front of them, and they feel like they have to come on, and if they feel like they have to catch up and whatever else, if they don't feel like they're taking the back seat, they will take the front seat. And so when you pitch and you come in with a prepared presentation, knowing everything about their business, can highlight trends that they haven't seen before, the value that you're providing, you're just displaying a mini presentation of what you'll do for the future with them at that time, and they can see it live. And when they see that live, it goes from theoretical to practical, and then all they have to do is say yes. So my advice to people on the trying to get a higher win rate is prepare in advance, get the financials in advance, create a presentation, and when you walk through it with them, you're displaying your value on that pitch call, and take that time to do it. You'll have a higher win rate.
So what resonates with me there is people don't really believe what you tell them, but they believe what they see, right? They believe what you do, right? And it's, you can, you know, in a sales situation, people say whatever it takes, right? Sometimes, you know, like, or they could say whatever they want. Maybe they believe it themselves. It may not actually be true. But if you actually have demonstrated work that you can't put your, you can't fake, if you like, then that in and of itself as well, if they, even simple things like, you know, do they turn up for a meeting on time? Do they do what they said they were going to do? You know, all these hygiene levels. And then if you can go beyond that. So give me an example. Let's say, I don't know, let's say you're pitching for our business. You say, okay, you want my accounts. Like, it might be a business. Maybe you're not super familiar with SaaS businesses. Like, how do you come up? How do you, because there's always a risk that you come in and saying, telling people how to suck eggs, right? There's a risk that you're like, oh, you know, I see it in your accounts. You're spending whatever, too much on Heroku and other clients shouldn't be or whatever. You know, like there's a risk that you can come in with advice that it is immature because you're not that familiar with it. So how do you walk that line to make sure you're not doing that?
Yeah, well, I can actually give you a live example of something that we did, and it actually led to value later on. So we had a retailer that we requested that we had a quick intro meeting just to understand who they were. And we requested their financials and, you know, after an NDA and whatever else. And the thing that we saw, even though we don't know 100% on everything being accurate, what we saw though is that their inventory was going from, let's say, you know, 5 or 6 turns per year going down to 1, right? And they had $few million in inventory. And so we pointed it out on the pitch call and we said, hey, you know, I don't know if you guys are paying attention to this, but there's a trend here of you're not turning your inventory as quickly, stacking up a lot of inventory. You know, maybe that's something we should definitely focus on if we were to engage. And they didn't have any idea of that going on. And, you know, let me save the rest of it for later. But when we showed them that, they said, oh, you know, I thought we had something. You know, I didn't know that it was this bad, but I felt that inventory was a problem. This is definitely something we want to focus on. You're hired. Right. That was really it. So if you get the general trends of things, even if it's not exact, you can point out areas that you want to explore without saying this is what you should do.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great example. And in that case, there was a e-commerce business, right? Yeah. And how much profit were you able to free up for them? And more specifically, how did you go about it? Like, so they had a lot of stock on the shelves. Mm-hmm. What was the blocking and tackling in terms of reducing that?
Yeah, so after we got engaged, that was the big thing that we were looking into, and we're saying what's happening with inventory here. So the first thing we had to understand is what's the process of how they were actually calculating inventory. The big thing is we're only as good as the data we get, and garbage in, garbage out. Mm. Once we're able to understand their process and ensure that it was correct, we're saying, okay, hold on a second. How are you guys making your purchasing decisions? How do you demand plan for inventory? Like, where is it held? Is it in Shopify or is it in some other system? We ended up finding that it was in Shopify, but there was no way for them to understand and really manage their inventory except for having, you know, 15 different spreadsheets manually entered when they bought something, right? So some type of archaic workaround manual process. And what we were able to do, a little bit of a custom solution, was create an automation that through Shopify and Excel that was able to say every single item of the inventory, when it was purchased, when it was sold, and the type of SKU that it was sold and when. And we're able to see these are the SKUs that have not sold in a year. These are the SKUs that have never been sold, right? These are the SKUs that you sell often. And what we're able to discover is that of that 3 million or so of inventory, there was about a million that had either never been sold or wasn't sold in a year or two. And we said, you know, Black Friday is coming up. It's time to sell all these things or put some type of discount or figure it out. But they had no visibility into it. Once they had the visibility and we showed them what was going on, they were able to go in, they were able to sell it, and they were able to add $750,000 that was just sitting in inventory to their bottom line.
Okay. So what I heard there was what I call the finance operations air gap, right? For most SMBs, they grow up using QuickBooks or Xero, whatever, and then they're selling on Shopify, and there's a synergy there. If you can link the two and see what's going on, then, because I didn't really understand this as well. Like, by default, my accounting software is not really designed to help me run my business or identify these issues. And sometimes the solutions, the next step up, are very expensive, like going for NetSuite or an ERP or whatever. But the right CFO can help put a solution in place without having to go to that level. Some of those CFOs will say, come in and try and sell you on NetSuite, but there's often a halfway house there and an early win, an easy win, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Awesome. So how can people get in touch with you, Donnie? And more specifically, who should get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So the website, warriorgp.com, or my email, dmashich@warriorgp.com, is always fine. info@warriorgp.com is fine. I think, you know, for entrepreneurs or growing businesses that are usually, we say, about, you know, 2 to 3 million of revenue and up, and up until, let's say, the 35 to 40 range, if you're growing or if you're experiencing some type of difficulty, either, or you're going through a capital event, or, you know, we're a little bit more extensive in our services to offer a lot of different things like, you know, pitch decks, investor presentations, along with our core strategic finance and accounting. That's definitely the type of person that should reach out to us. And then obviously, if you're a CFO that just wants to collaborate or hear more, you know, we also offer some solutions in that arena as well, trying to give other CFOs the business model that we have. So if that's something interesting and that resonates, you know, we can artificially create the deal team for other fractional CFOs so they could leverage the same things that we do.
Okay, great. So, all right. And then I have my last question I ask every guest, which is, who is your business hero and why?
Yeah. So business hero is Howard Marks. He's the founder, CEO, or, you know, maybe chief investment officer at Oak Tree Capital Management. He's a big investor and a bit contrarian in nature, even though he's very successful. And I think he taught me a lot just through the books, obviously, about how to really think about and internalize things regardless, you know, irrespective of what everyone else says. It has to make sense. A lot of times popular opinion isn't correct opinion. And if you're going into the market and you're trying to get above average returns, you can't do the same thing as everyone else. If you're going to be successful, you have to do something different. You got to make sure it's smart, but you got to do something different.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks very much, Donnie. And thank you for listening this far. If you are a fractional CFO and you want my take on how you can explain the value of a fractional CFO better to CEOs, I've got a webinar up at procurementexpress.com/partners. In my view, a fractional CFO, exactly in the range Donnie's talking about here, a couple of million in revenue. Maybe you've bootstrapped it. Maybe you've built it up from a family business, whatever. You probably don't know what you're sitting on in terms of value. And there is only one hire that can help you realize that value, and that's a CFO. You might think it's a salesperson, you might think it's someone on your ops teams, but it's not, I'm telling you now. And if you haven't considered hiring a CFO, they're the ones who can literally make your dreams come true. You don't think your accountant's going to make your life come true, but believe me, they can. So go to procurementexpress.com/partners, learn if you're a CFO or CEO rather, why you should get one, or maybe you'll have a fresh take on how to sell that value there to prospects. Thanks very much, Donnie. This has been great.
Thank you, James.